This episode of The Tome Show is brought to you by RPGNow.com, your leading source of PDF game products and listeners like you. Thanks for using The Tome's Amazon store. Welcome to The Tome, episode 114. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interview show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, we're going to brave the convention floor and bring you an interview with Bruce Cordell and Andy Collins of Wizards of the Coast while at Gen Con 2009. Before I introduce you to those two, however, let me tell you about our sponsor for this episode, RPGNow.com. RPGNow is your leading source of PDF game products. If you don't mind not having a paper copy, and really, in this day and age, going paperless is really the thing to do, then RPG Now has the product for you. They're great for inexpensive dungeon tiles, DM screens, adventures, and more, for several D&D editions, and more. My pick for this episode is Clever Classes Explorer, from Alluria Publishing. This is a 4th edition class that fills in the martial controller slot. The idea of this class is that they use various things like a combination of ranged and melee weapons, as well as beast companions and the like, to make it hard for your enemies to go where they want to go on the battlefield. It's an interesting looking class, and the production values, layouts, and art are nearly up to snuff with what you would see from Wizards of the Coast themselves. You can find a link to this product at RPGNow.com in the show notes at thetomeshow.com.
Get the newest releases at RPG Now. Only at RPG Now can you get the absolute latest and best releases from fantastic publishers like Palladium Books and White Wolf Publishing. There are new products every single day. Come to RPGNow.com and get them the instant they're available.
Now, let me tell you a bit about this interview. Benton and Jason were at Gen Con, the world's largest gaming convention, a few weeks ago, and sat down with Bruce Cordell, who works at Wizards of the Coast writing Forgotten Realms novels as well as game books, and Andy Collins, who you may recall I interviewed way back before 4th edition came out. He's sort of the big number-crunching guy, the mechanics guy over at Wizards of the Coast. The Vorpal Network crew was at the convention to interview a few other folks, including Joseph Goodman of Goodman Games, which you'll find over at Gamers Haven, and James Wyatt and Bill Slavasek, both from Wizards of the Coast. Wyatt is a game designer, and Slavasek oversees the D&D brand. And you can find that interview at Fistful of Comics and Games. Links to both of those interviews will be in the show notes at thetomeshow.com. And with that taken care of, let me turn it over to Benton and Jason from the floor of Gen Con 2009.
Hi, this is Benton from Fistful of Comics and Games. I'm at Gen Con 2009 here with Bruce Cordell and Andy Collins. And I'm here with
Jason Hunter. I'm with the Tome Show.
Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having us.
So how's the con been so far for you guys?
It's actually been really fabulous. Things were going pretty well, but then last night we attended the Annie's, and it turned out that the fans and the community of judges associated with the Annie's really accepted 4th edition, and we came home with about 10 awards, and that was really nice to see. We were all very happy and very excited and very thankful for that.
It's been a great weekend.
Cool. So, as far as rules go, 4th edition seemed fairly, I want to say simple, but clean when it first came out. But you found a lot of design space in surprising places. And I was just wondering, are there any future areas of the rules that you're going to expand upon? Like, I mean, Psionics had like a PowerPoint system and
I would say it's going to be hard for us not to continue expanding the rules into new and interesting places. We never want the game to get old or stale. We want to continue to provide people with interesting options, particularly things they might not be able to create on their own. Right? We feel like we've done a pretty good job of setting up a strong framework to work from and to build on, and now it's just a matter of, all right, what new ideas can we come up with this month?
I think when you brought up the psionic system, that's kind of an example of where we came up with something that people probably weren't expecting. They saw the rules going in a particular fashion, and we thought, what can we do that can just really still work within the rules framework, but actually take things in a completely different direction that are just really going to surprise people? And that's the kind of thing that we're going to continue to do as we move forward in the edition.
Right. It's one of the huge advantages of the investment we made in the game's infrastructure, being able to create a system where we know what the numbers should be at all the different levels, means that when we innovate, we know sort of what the parameters and boundaries are for that innovation. We can be very creative, but still fit it within a framework without it going completely off in left field and breaking the game apart.
So how do you, when it comes to actually a new book coming out with new mechanics in it, now do you have input into that, or is that something that has to come across your desk to, you know, kind of make sure that the rules mechanics kind of work?
Generally speaking, a book will have its basic topics agreed upon in advance, right? We know sort of the title and the general themes of our books months, generally often years in advance. We have to plan out that far. But with that framework, then we really turn it over to the design team, like Bruce here, and say, okay, what's going to be in this book about metallic dragons or the undead or what have you?
Yeah, for instance, I'm working on a project recently, we had the basic concepts for what the book was going to be about, and as the design lead for it, I called a meeting which included the designers that I had available to me at the time, but also the developers that were going to be working on the book, the editors that were going to be working on the book, and people higher up, the development leads, and we all sat down and just brainstormed with the idea of what, you know, the topic's going to fill out this book, and then I built an outline based on that, sent it around again, and constantly. The great thing about Wizards is that we've actually built teams that actually work really well cooperatively with each other, and each idea that comes about isn't watered down, it's actually expanded upon and improved, and I think that's what makes our ability to create great books, so that's why it works.
The creative process, really from day one, is a constant process of honing ideas. Designers will say, what about this? And they'll get feedback from folks that will strengthen those ideas, and then they'll come back with the new ones, and that cycle just continues over and over again throughout design, development, and editing, right up to really the book is leaving the building.
I guess a follow-up to what Benton was asking, is there a fear that with this design, you know, the space that you guys have, and as you said, you know, the need to continue to innovate in new, interesting places, is there a fear that at some point you'll be too cumbersome and it'll be too difficult for someone new to come into the game?
It's something we're very aware of, and we consciously work to pace ourselves. I mean, the Player's Handbook itself is a pretty good example. A lot of folks were expecting, for instance, more classes or more races in that book. It felt like a step back for some people from third edition's range of options. But what we knew was, with this new game system, we had to start people a little bit slower, not inundate them with too many classes or races or what have you right out of the gate. We knew we'd have time and that we'd be able to get to all the favorites as well as plenty of new ones. But yeah, the idea of overwhelming people with options is something we're very aware of. We're hoping that tools like D&D Insider help people manage those options rather than being scattered over lots of books. They can have it all in one handy character builder, for instance, or monster builder. And then it's not like there are a lot of books. It's like there's one book that has everything perfectly sorted for you. we hope to take advantage of those tools in that way.
I was going to say the same thing. The DDI character builder, the way it's set up is every time you have a choice at a particular level, only the choices that matter for you at that level are displayed, so you're not facing this huge array of rules as you might with just an analog book or a stack of analog books, right? I've become fifth level, I have to choose something. Oh, here are the choices for me right here. Choose, next. So even as we add more and more books and articles throughout the years, the character builder is going to be a wonderful way of sorting and filtering and making the life of even a new player just a breeze.
So those changes and those upgrades and those additions to the rules will be filtered into the D&D Insider as we go along.
The character builder and now the new monster builder are going to be updated every month with all the content that has come out to that point. So it's just a constant rolling set of updates. New books get dropped in, new articles get dropped in, and then all of a sudden, you know, you're playing that paladin, and bing, divine power options show up on your character. So your number of power options go from 3 to 6, and get up a level, for instance. Woohoo!
And sometimes we debut content early. For instance, many of the Player's Handbook 3 pieces that will be... Player's Handbook 3 is coming out next year sometime, but we're seeing the Scion, we're seeing the Monk, other things coming out early in the character builder to kind of show you what you can expect.
And to reward those Insider subscribers.
So I was just curious, with some of the Dragon articles, I know Player's Handbook 3 previews, they're just previews of what's to come, but some of the other articles, are they, you sort of use them to gauge the interest so you know you can make more of it in the future, or is it...
Absolutely. We see Dragon and Dungeon magazines as great test beds for new concepts. Maybe they are a little experimental to publish in a book, or just not... sort of a little fringe enough that we don't want to do 20 or 30 or 50 versions of this power, but we might try five in this new theme. And it lets us exactly test those waters, say, what's the reaction to this? You know, should we be expanding on this in the future of the game? I think it's a marvelous tool for that. Because it also allows us to turn content around and get reactions much faster than a book, right? We work on a book for often upwards of a year before it gets published, whereas an Insider article, it could be start to finish in a month or less.
Cool. So you're on the design side, Bruce.
Yeah.
So tell me some of the things that we can see from you on the design side, especially Forgotten Realms. I'm a big Forgotten Realms fan. I always have been.
The thing I was actually working on most recently was Dark Sun, so I can finally talk about that. But as far as Forgotten Realms goes, the way we support our campaign settings after the initial push into print product is on DDI. So if you're a member of DDI, you've been seeing regular Forgotten Realms content rolling out on a monthly basis, actually.
So we have Ed Greenwood starting up a new column. He's going to be writing for us, coming back writing for the Realms.
Called Eye on the Realms. He's going to pretty much do whatever he wants in each one of those articles. Very portable.
Nice.
Very portable little articles, though. It's not going to be a geographical-based thing. You know, one time he'll be talking about a cursed artifact. Another time he'll be talking about some mercenary company. You know, just interesting, very interesting things the DM can take and put in their campaign, whether Realms or not, but it is definitely Realms. Other Realms-based things you can look forward to are you a novel reader at all for other Realms?
Yes.
We're trying to integrate novels and game material a lot more. So if you read various novels, you'll see that there's game articles set in Dungeon that are taken from the novels, a particular place in the novel, and worked into an encounter or two and then released on Dungeon. So things like that. More region write-ups, like the Air Spur, there's going to be a total of 3 articles. Narrowing down on this one city in the realms. We're going to do that more. I was in a Forgotten Realms seminar, and we were asking the audience like what other cities they might be interested in seeing. We got a lot of good feedback on that, so you can expect more of those types of articles as well.
What were some of those that were mentioned?
Actually, it was a pretty long list that spanned the gauntlet from like Waterdeep and Westgate to some far more smaller places that I'd I have a list that I can't bring to mind at the moment, but sure. Some of them, you know, Westgate. I'm like, ooh, Westgate. Yeah. So maybe think about Westgate. That might show up. So
okay. Another big venue for us for Forgotten Realms content is the Living Forgotten Realms campaign from the RPGA. Obviously, they're publishing dozens of adventures a year that are set in various areas of the realms, and that's another way for players to really get involved in realms gaming.
Is some of that content going to find its way into maybe ideas for novels or maybe other content?
In fact, that there is going to be, it's called The Fall of Highgate. Now I can't think of the actual name, but there's going to be a novel coming out towards the end of, middle of 2010 that actually has a LFR adventure tied to it. It's by, the novel's by Mark Sehested. And the novel is going to take place, and the adventure is going to take place immediately in the aftermath of this first novel. It's actually going to be a novel trilogy. So yeah, so we're actually moving in that direction, and you'll probably see more of that.
One of your upcoming novel series, I believe, it has to do with Abolus.
That's right.
Just curious, was that a... Is that you integrating? You have an affinity for psionic alien type stuff.
You've been pigeonholed.
Well, to some extent, what Andy just said is true. I have gained a reputation for that, and so when things like that come up, people think, well, Bruce would probably be good to write this sort of thing. As it happened, I was the lead for the Forgotten Realms campaign guide for 4th edition, and there had been the development of this floating city of Abolus called the Abolethic Sovereignty over the city, the Sea of Fallen Stars, and people wanted to know, well, why is there a city of Abolus floating over the Sea of Fallen Stars? Bruce, why don't you write some novels and tell us about why that exactly is? So I was happy to do so. And the second book in that trilogy is coming out in September called City of Torment. The first one was last year, Plague of Spells.
Okay. So, what can you tell us about Dark Sun? What can we expect from that campaign setting that we might not be expecting?
Well, we've been very excited working on it over the last few months. I think sometimes surprised at how well the 4th edition mindset fits into the history of Dark Sun. We're holding back a lot of information right now. Obviously, we've got a long time to go before this is published, a whole year. We've got a very robust plan of previews and debut content scheduled for the year. But one thing that Bill did confirm yesterday in our seminar was that we would be returning to the Dark Sun setting of the original box set. We're not looking to advance a timeline or anything. We're going to go back to the classic, iconic time and space of Dark Sun and start again from there. Bruce has actually been working on the setting.
That's true. So I kind of don't want to reveal anything that, you know, would be surprising. But I was just sitting with Bill in a previous interview, and he did say something. He said, it'll be surprising what we do with how we deal with classes. That is what he said. So I can look forward to that surprise.
Personally, I'm looking forward to going back to the office. The development on the book starts in about a week. So the designers are literally putting the final touches on it this week. So I'm looking forward to getting the manuscript and really digging into it.
So during this con, there's been some talk of the assassin class, and it's the first shadow-based class so far. How is that? Is that going to be released on Dragon?
Or? That's coming out in Dragon Magazine as a D&D Insider exclusive. We're showcasing sort of a sneak preview of it here. New subscribers are getting a playable assassin character that they can use here in the campaign, as well as a short adventure drawn from Dungeon Magazine, sort of to show folks, hey, this is what you're getting. The assassin is slated to go up in September. Brand new, fully playable class, shadow power source. Again, I'm very excited. I was involved in some of the development work on the class, and I'm very pleased that we were able to create a character that feels very different from the classes that have come before. He's got some interesting new mechanics and themes and story behind him. I think players are going to really groove on it.
So I'm going to say it kind of takes some of the Shadow Dancer
There's a little, bit of that. He's definitely a sneaky guy in a different way than, say, a rogue might be. When you see an assassin and a rogue in play together, they will look and feel very, very different. Again, both from a standpoint of mechanically what are they doing, and also what's the story, how is this character's powers working, and what do they look like on the battlefield. We think that's a really important part of class design, is not simply to focus on what are the numbers, but what's the story behind the class. If it doesn't have a cool hook, we're not going to put it in a book. And we've killed classes in design and development before that have come through and looked functional, but they were just lacking that, why do I want to play this guy? What is he doing in the world? So we take that very, very seriously in our class building.
I want to know favorites. You guys deal with this stuff on a daily basis, whether you're writing the novels or you're working on the rules or putting together classes or mechanics. What are some favorites in 4th edition that you really enjoy and you looked at and say, that's good, I like that?
I really like, I just have a personal affinity for the Warlock. I love the Warlock. I love the way the story of the Warlock works, making packs. It's just so rife with story possibilities. Like, you're pledging yourself to what entity? You know, some Duke from Hell, something from the Far Realm, some crazy wild creature out of the Feywild. I just really like it. I enjoy playing the Warlock, and I enjoy thinking about the Warlock and for writing additional articles about the Warlock.
The Warlock may be one of the best examples out of the Player's Handbook of that melding of story and mechanics. We're really proud of him. Personally, one of my favorite parts, there's so many, but one of my favorite parts of 4th edition D&D is how much more active and vibrant the combats have become. I've found combats in previous editions of the game tended to get very bogged down. You know, the monsters and characters run together and they just stand next to each other and smash. The great number of powers that allow for free movement around the battlefield or pushing or sliding foes means that the combats become more interesting. Tactical positioning is a greater value, but it also means the environment around the combat becomes more meaningful, right? The room, you can't get away with a fight in a big square room anymore. I think that's great. It's a big challenge to adventure designers, but it makes the game so much more fun. Monsters and characters chasing each other, running around, sliding, jumping, falling. I find the combat's just so much more interesting, both on a tactical level and just a visual, imagining what's going on.
So in the near future, you're going to be releasing a book about the Elemental Chaos. Is that going to be sort of a campaign setting style fleshing out, or something a bit more along the lines of Manual of the Planes?
It's sort of a hybrid of the two, really.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of saying it. It definitely has Manual of the Planes type write-ups, but it has a lot of actual, you know, lair type situations and monsters and stuff like that that you can just like drop in and say, oh, my players have taken a portal or fallen into this portal or whatever, for whatever reason they've taken a brief detour into the Elemental Chaos, and here, look, there's this whole slot community that they have to deal with, something like that. So it's pretty cool.
We're really trying in our DM-focused books, like Plane Below, to provide not only great story and setting content, but also tools for them to use in their game, whether that's new terrain features, pre-generated lairs, new monster stat blocks, things like that that the DM can not only be inspired by, but actually use, right? Because the great story that might inspire an idea is very useful, but a lot of DMs also are crunched for time. They need a little help now and then in putting together their adventures. So I like the idea that you could crack the book open and just go, ooh, I'm going to use that encounter and those new monsters and put then that terrain features. We've done a lot of the DM's work for him.
I was just curious if you is the Abyss going to show up at all in there, or is that going to
absolutely? Yeah, the Abyss is a major section of the Elemental Chaos, and it's going to get plenty of treatment in Plane Below.
If you're interested in the Abyss, also the third adventure of the adventure series will also feature some content taking place in the Abyss.
That's the Prince of Undeath. Yeah, third of the epic tier of adventures that rounds out our first adventure series. Get to fight Orcus.
That's right.
Nice. All right, so you released the Open Grave and Draconomicon 1. Draconomicon 2 is due out fairly soon.
This fall, yeah.
Anything interesting that you haven't talked about yet that's come out for that?
I wasn't actually at the extravaganza. I don't know what announced.
Obviously, the second Draconomicon volume focuses on the metallic dragons, which appeared for the first time in Monster Manual 2. This provides many more metallic dragons that appeared in there, as well as plenty of information on the kinds of lairs they keep, how they interact with characters. We really tried to focus in this book on explaining how you and why you'd want to use metallic dragons in your campaign. They're not just the friendly goody-good dragons that you might have seen in previous adventures and editions. These are scary monsters. They might be allies, or they might be tyrants. Even the ones that might be good aligned have their own agendas that don't necessarily mesh with those of characters or human kingdoms. So we wanted to bring back some of the awe and mystery that dragons should have, and I think the book does a pretty good job of that.
Cool. Is there anything that you're particularly looking forward to with the Player's Handbook 3 that's gonna bring to the game, in particular race or...
I think leaving Psionics out of it, because that is the thing I'm most excited about for Player's Handbook 3, I think that people who love Psionics will love that, but I think a lot of people who have been looking for a more robust, a more complex way of making their characters multi-class will really enjoy the hybrid character system that Mike Merle's championed. It's gone through a couple layers of series of playtest already, and we're slowly working it and going to make it a really cool system for really making your characters a custom hybrid.
One of the things I'm excited about Player's Handbook 3 is the wealth of options it's going to have even for existing characters. Player's Handbook 2 really was focusing on the new classes and races. With Player's Handbook 3, we wanted to balance that approach with, for instance, the hybrid system, which existing characters might use to rejigger themselves, or more feats for characters who maybe aren't using the new classes. So we want to make that book a little broader appeal to folks, and I'm pretty excited about that.
I thought I saw online there was a Dragonborn book due out January, and
that's right.
Not sure what that.
That's the first of a new series of products that is beginning next year. Our Player's Handbook Races series. These are 32-page books, $10. So very sort of impulse level buy that focus on individual races, combination of story content and new mechanics for those races. Basically, we want this to be the must-buy for the players of those races. If you're playing a Dragonborn, you want this book because it's going to tell you all the cool things you want to know about the Dragonborn, give you some more background hooks for your characters, some more story to inspire your role-playing, as well as help build your character. We're going to follow it up with Tieflings, slated for the summer of that year, and we hope to continue hitting the high points of our races for as long as we can.
Cool. I'm good.
Okay.
I kept hearing, when you're talking about the assassin character class, I kept hearing Erebus Kale from the Forgotten Realms. I keep thinking of that kind of, is that what we're...
I don't think we necessarily had any particular book characters in mind. Assassins in the past have tended to be almost indistinguishable from rogues or thieves, very closely linked. We wanted to try and move them apart, so it's probably more likely that this class will go further afield than maybe we our book characters that we're called assassins have. But I think that it's exactly that going a little further that is going to help the players go, okay, this is what makes me unique.
I'm impressed you guys have all these questions in your head.
Well, is there anything coming out soon that you'd like to talk about? Or
gosh, well, obviously the One of the big buzzes this year is Dark Sun coming out next year. But in addition to that, we've got a couple other exciting products. Heroescape is going to enter the world of Dungeons & Dragons for the first time early next year. We're pretty excited by that. Heroescape is a game that Wizards sort of inherited from Hasbro as part of the merger. So we've had a mix of Hasbro designers and Wizards staff working on bringing that game to life. We also have Dungeons & Dragons board game coming out next year. Big deluxe game, the Castle Ravenloft game. Cooperative board game for anywhere from 1 to 5 players. Looking at about a $60-$65 price point. So we're hoping to deliver. It will be similar to Dungeons and Dragons, so you know, the sort of maybe 12 and up, high school and up. But there's a lot of demand that's been growing over the years for high-quality board games. Certainly, we are diehard board gamers as well, right? I have Fear of Dracula and Battlestar and you know, name off the list. And we feel this is the right time for D&D to start exploring some new areas for the brand. Let people interact with the worlds of Dungeons & Dragons in a little different way. In this case, a shorter venue than maybe a full role-playing session lets you sort of spin the game in a little different way.
I'm very excited about that board game, too. One of the very first things I did as a kid when I first started playing D is to make it into a little board game, you know, just little figures, just a very simple little things. I don't know, so it's something that's near and dear to my heart. Very excited to see it come out.
And a little smaller profile than that, but a personal favorite of mine, we're finally going to be producing a deluxe Dungeon Tiles set. We're calling it the Dungeon Tiles Master Set. 10 double-sided sheets of Dungeon Tiles drawn from past sets, so bringing back tiles that folks have trouble finding. We're going to keep it in stock so that we, as adventure designers, we can keep referring back to that set and DMs will know they can get it. It's going to be a great sort of starter product for the DM who's looking to get into Dungeon Tiles. Nice box. Even the box is going to be functional. It's going to be printed with grids on both of the top and the bottom, so you can use them as Dungeon Tile platforms in conjunction with the 3D Dungeon Tiles that we're going to be coming out with starting later this year.
So I kind of want to ask a question that has nothing to do with necessarily Wizards or D&D or anything like that.
No, I'm sorry, we can't answer that.
We're at this massive convention, right? What have you guys seen that really impresses you this weekend? You've been here for a couple of days. This is my first day here at the convention so far. So what do I want to go see that you guys have seen that's impressed you?
Well, let's see. It just basically it's the spectacle of it that is so amazing. I mean, the hall is huge. It's just thronged with people so excited to be here and to be playing these games, and people of all ages, too. I mean, we've heard that this might be a graying community, but I'm seeing so many people that are like 13, 14. You know, we see the little kids that their parents bring, but we're also seeing like kids here on their own, you know, 15, 16-year-olds, you know, young 20s, you know, just little groups of people. It's really cool just to see so many people having such a great time.
Yeah, I have to echo that. One of my favorite things at Gen Con is just people watch, right? Just sort of step back for a moment and look at all these people coming from all walks of life together to share this immense passion for the hobby, right? It's more than just any one game, right? I love it if they all played D&D, but that doesn't matter here. What matters is that we're all together, we're with people like ourselves. We're very fortunate that we work in an office surrounded by others like us, but we recognize most people don't have that luxury. A lot of people, when they leave here, are going to go back someplace and retreat back into sort of a gamer cocoon, nobody around them knowing about what they love. But here, we can let that flag fly, right? And you can do whatever your particular area of geekdom is proudly without any fear of people judging you. This is one of the most accepting communities I've ever seen. I mean, because you don't get that in a lot of other places.
I accepted my geekdom years ago.
Yes, yes.
It is what it is. I am who I am.
Right, right.
And you mentioned the little kids. My 8-year-old daughter will be coming with me tomorrow.
Wonderful.
Congratulations.
Wonderful.
So, us gamers have been around for a while.
Yeah.
We're bringing the kids up right.
It is very literally the next generation of gaming that I've been seeing over the last several years, right? We've talked about it for a long time, and it it's happening now. Yeah. Right? There are folks bringing their kids into gaming, whether it's conventions or playing Magic at home or getting into a D&D game with their kids and their kids' friends. Right? I mean, it's sort of almost unthinkable when I cast my thoughts back to 20, 25, 30 years ago, right, that you could have that sort of turnover and kids going, yeah, my folks play this game, I'll play it with them. That's so fabulous, right? How can you ask for a better family relationship than that?
Well, I guess that about wraps it up. I'd like to thank you for taking your time out with us. And
you're welcome. It's our pleasure.
Yeah,
we could talk about this sort of thing for days.
Yeah, we love it.
Probably going to.
Well, with that, Spitball Comics and Games. And bye.
Thank you. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Thanks again to Benton and Jason of Fistful of Comics and Games, as well as Bruce Cordell and Andy Collins from Wizards of the Coast for joining us in this episode. Well, that's episode 114. Email me at thetomeshow@gmail.com or visit the forums once we get them installed. I've been saying that a long time now. We got to get on that. Review the show on iTunes or tell folks about it. And don't forget to consider checking out the Tome's Amazon store for products discussed on the show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air. Links for things mentioned in the show can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com. This has been the mind-bending, number-crunching episode 114. Bruce Cordell and Andy Collins, both obeying the shower-once-a-day rule, I'm sure, at Gen Con 2009 of...
I'm on the wall.